This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, we'll discuss some uncomfortable questions about torture. A new book of essays is out. It explores the issue within a post-9/11 context. A little bit later in the program, we'll hear from an absolutist who holds with the United Nations Convention, which says it cannot be permitted under any circumstances whatsoever. But we begin with a famed civil libertarian and human rights advocate who argues that the best way to minimize or eliminate torture is to find ways to make it accountable. Alan Dershowitz is a professor at Harvard Law School, one of the best-known attorneys in the country. He joins us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Your argument assumes that the United States and its allies are using torture or something close to it today, and that we'd be better off to admit that and debate these issues openly.
Yeah, I wish we could abolish torture. No country in the world has ever done it when faced with real crises and terrorist prevention needs. And I'm a pragmatist and a realist. And as long as we have Abu Ghraibs and as long as we have Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, who are subjecting to waterboarding and other forms of gross and rough interrogation techniques, whether you call them torture or not, we ought to have methods of regulating them. And my suggestion is a very simple one. That is, any extraordinary interrogation method that goes beyond the usual Miranda warnings should require extraordinary measures. You should require making the extraordinary case to either the Chief Justice of the United States or the President of the United States and making them sign off on why we need to do this, why we need to violate our general norms. That will prevent Abu Ghraibs, in which there was no need and there were low-ranking, unimportant people, and we had sergeants and privates making the decision, basically, whether to expose them to these extraordinary techniques. I want accountability. I don't want torture. I want less torture and more accountability.
We want to hear from you listeners on torture. What is it? Where's the line? Is everything up to the legal definition of torture okay? Is torture barred under every circumstance? Does 9/11 change things? Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Alan Dershowitz, this idea of a torture warrant signed by the President of the United States or the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, doesn't that normalize torture in a way?
Quite the opposite. What it says is that anything that's beyond the ordinary interrogation method must be justified by the most extraordinary need, say the ticking bomb terrorist case, the nuclear weapon, the harbor of New York City. We know what we would do if we ever found the terrorist whose friend had planted the bomb in New York City. We know that he would be tortured. In fact, the vast majority of Americans would want him to be tortured if it would be effective. We just don't want to know about it. We don't want to confront it. We know also that torture, tragically, can be effective sometimes. In the Philippines, for example, a person was tortured for several days and revealed the plot to blow up the 14 airplanes over the Pacific. Of course, nobody believes what you say in the torture, and they shouldn't. So the people who tortured him said, well, take us to where the explosives are, and he did. And he thwarted the plot and also thwarted a plot on the assassination of the Pope. So we know it can sometimes work. We know it would be used. I don't want to normalize it, but I want to make its extraordinary use truly extraordinary, and I want to make the people who decide to do it accountable. Just like if an airplane were being flown again toward the Empire State Building this time, the president would want it to be, we'd all want it to be shot down if it could prevent crashing into a busy building. We wouldn't want that decision to be made by a low-ranking policeman on the street. We'd want that extraordinary decision to be made by the president or the secretary of defense so that in the event he's wrong and the plane hadn't been hijacked, we know who to hold accountable for it. Accountability is essential in a democracy. Abu Ghraib proves what happens when you don't have accountability, when you have the president saying, oh, we never would accept torture. After all, the convention's all prohibited. And then with a wink and a nod, the message is sent down to the people on the ground, do whatever it is you have to do to get as much information as possible to save as many lives as possible. Those are conflicting messages which inevitably lead to events like Abu Ghraib.
So hypocrisy, in this case, you argue, is the source of the problem.
It's the source. It's also the symptom of the problem. And many countries opt for hypocrisy. In fact, several philosophers have argued explicitly, do it, but don't tell us about it. Don't make it lawful. It's better to create a precedent of keeping it under the table than to create a precedent of legitimating it. I take exactly the opposite view. The worst precedent is the one that says you can do it without accountability. Just don't tell us about it. When you have accountability, for example, when the United States Supreme Court validated the detention of 110,000 Japanese Americans in concentration camps, that sounded like a terrible precedent. But the fact that it was validated by the Supreme Court made it clear that it would never happen again, because world opinion turned so against it, and American opinion, that after 9/11 we didn't lock up 110,000 Arab and Muslims. We did lock up 1,000, but we had to find different justifications for it. So when you make a problem explicit, you make its recurrence less likely. I've written a whole book on this subject now called Rights from Wrongs, where I argue that rights come out of a recognition of the wrongs of the past. And if you're going to have a viable system of rights, you have to acknowledge the wrongs of the past, and you have to bring them to the surface instead of hiding them as we do with torture.
Our number, if you'd like to join our conversation on torture, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Right now we're speaking with Alan Dershowitz, the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard University. Let's get a caller on the line. This is Esther, who joins us from Ithaca, New York.
Hi, Esther.
Hi there. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just going to say that I think that the increased use of torture, and in particular the publicized use of torture that occurred at Abu Ghraib, puts our own military at risk. And I imagine that it must also make, potential terrorists feel that they can kind of do anything. And in the recent killings of hostages in Iraq, where they were beheaded, I wonder if the increased use of torture by the Americans might have caused those particular terrorists to do those things?
It's a good question. It's an empirical question. That is, would these terrorists, who we know have a history of doing these terrible things even before Abu Ghraib, would they have been less likely to do them? After all, the reason we all sign on to these treaties against torture is reciprocity. We won't torture your people, you don't torture our people. We're fighting, of course, an asymmetrical war against terrorists. They do anything they choose to do, and they're not bound by the same rules, and yet we still insist on complying with our own rules. George Washington, when he was fighting the revolution and the British were conducting terrible campaigns against civilians, putting people in churches and burning them down, George Washington said, "We will not do what they do. We will win this war, and we will win it the right way." And that set a wonderful tone, I think, for American history, in which we have done things better than our enemies have done to us. And I think the reason why we should do everything in our power to reduce and eliminate torture is not for the reasons of reciprocity, but because we recognize that it's just the wrong way to approach this. But
yes,
if we ever had a ticking bomb terrorist case, we would use torture. And if we did, and if we didn't, by the way, if a president could have prevented 9/11 and didn't do it because he felt that somehow it would be wrong to use torture, that president, though, would suffer politically a terrible result, because Americans want the president to protect them no matter what it takes.
Would he suffer in history, though?
I think he would. I think, like Neville Chamberlain suffered for not engaging in preemptive war against Hitler, a preemptive war which may have been unlawful, I think history has treated Neville Chamberlain and those who allowed Nazism to thrive pretty roughly. I think history expects leaders to do whatever it takes to prevent horrible events from occurring if they have the option of doing it differently. The point is, empirically, we would do it. I know we would do it. I spoke to the Prime Minister of Australia once, just after what happened to them at Bali happened, and said, if you knew in advance, what would it take for you to have prevented it? And he said, we would do anything we had to do to prevent a recurrence of Bali. And I think a president today would do the same thing. Remember, presidents don't win elections because they comply generally with the Marquis of Queensberry rules. They win elections because they are effective and prevent our civilians from being hurt. I just want to regulate that. I want to make it accountable.
Esther, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Here's an email question. This from Stephen Ayers in Prescott, Arizona. You said, if it would be effective, has it ever been established, he writes, that torture actually is effective as a technique?
Unfortunately, yes, it has been established. I mentioned the Philippine case. There are two cases, documented cases, in Israel where buses were going to be blown up, and the use of, they didn't call it torture, but rough interrogation techniques, putting hoods on people and shaking them and putting them in dark, smelly rooms with loud music, produced evidence that stopped buses from being exploded. And there was one case where they didn't use it, and a bus was blown up. So at least those who specialize in it believe that it's generally an ineffective technique, but in the extraordinary case, it might be effective, and that's why a warrant requirement would be good, because if it weren't effective, then the president wouldn't grant the warrant, and the Chief Justice wouldn't grant the warrant. Whoever is seeking it would have the burden of proving, A, that this was genuinely a terrorist, B, that every other alternative method hasn't worked, and C, that this would be effective. Right now, we don't require that showing to be made. We just assume its effectiveness.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is a caller who's asked to remain anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I respect Mr. Dershowitz's opinion quite a bit, actually, but I feel that the effectiveness of torture when it is used is lost if you have to go to a certain level. It's generally a time-sensitive event.
The bomb is ticking.
The bomb is ticking, or the weapons catch may be moved. There's a variety of reasons why it could be time sensitive. And
absolutely right.
And I don't know if Mr. Dershowitz, I haven't read your book, I'm sorry, but there are some incidents where I was stationed in Belfast that were also effective.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the British were rebuked by the European court for using what amounts to torture. You're absolutely right. It'd be very hard in some cases to get a warrant, and we have the same rule with international wiretaps. If you can get a warrant in advance, you got to get it. Otherwise, you get it after the fact, or you call the judge or the chief justice, and at least you make a record of what you're requesting. But plainly, it wouldn't be possible to get a full-blown warrant requirement in every case because it's always time-sensitive. There's another issue, too. If you have a warrant, the torture might be less effective because the person being tortured would know it's being subject to regulation. One of the most effective things in torture in the Philippine case, after they were unsuccessful, they said, now we're going to send you to Israel where the Mossad will really, really work you over. They weren't going to do that, but that was the threat. And that's
right,
when the guy broke.
Yes, that was one technique that I saw that was effective is you don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
We're going to use you until you are dry, and then we're going to discard you.
That's right. I mean, these techniques are less able to be used. And it's a compromise between effectiveness and accountability. We live in a world where imperfect solutions are always going to be demanded. And I just think accountability in a democracy is about as important as any value you can have short of the survival of the nation itself. And that's why I want to see a combination of accountability and effectiveness, with accountability being placed high on the hierarchy of values.
Thank you for the call.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. We just have a minute left, but I did want to get an email from Kathleen in Athens, Ohio, who points out the UN Convention, the United States, of course, is a signatory.
Yeah.
If the U.S. chooses not to follow these rules, how can we expect others to? This strategy only serves to infuriate nations around the world.
Well, every country that signed the treaty hypocritically uses torture and would use it in a case like this. I think we would set a very important lesson by writing a letter to the Convention saying we will continue to comply with it, except in the case of extraordinary ticking bomb techniques, and here's what we've done, and we urge other countries to do likewise, and not to follow the way of the hypocrite by proclaiming compliance while in practice not complying. I think we could lead the way to a more pragmatic, nuanced approach, and I think it would serve the interests of world compliance rather than the interest today of apparent compliance coupled with breaches across the board. Egypt, for example, today practices torture routinely against dissidents. Jordan practices it. And these are two of the best Arab countries in the Middle East. So right now, they're not complying with their obligations. Perfect. We know that. And it would be much better if we limited the time in which they can use it.
Alan Dershowitz, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today. More on this when we come back from break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cownan in Washington. We're talking today about torture. You're invited to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Sanford Levinson, professor of law and government at the University of Texas in Austin. Professor Levinson is in the studio at KUT in Austin, Texas. He's the editor of a new volume called Torture, a Collection. And Professor, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
There's a number of essays in this debate. We're shortly going to be joined by someone who believes that torture is unacceptable under any circumstances. But I wanted to talk to you about this conversation. There were some, I know, you approached who said even the idea of a discussion of torture was illegitimate.
Well, there's one contributor who was very concerned about being in the book for that reason. And in my own essay, which is entitled Contemplating Torture, and it's meant as a double entendre to refer not only to thinking about actually engaging in torture, but also even contemplating or thinking about torture more abstractly, there's at least one theorist who says basically exactly what you've just said, that it's like Holocaust denial, that to debate a Holocaust denier is to give some credence to the notion that maybe the Holocaust didn't really happen and that one ought not do that. And I respect that position, but I think ultimately it's wrong for some of the reasons that Alan Dershowitz has mentioned, that unfortunately torture does occur in the world. And one of the things that impelled me to try to put together this book is that literally within a month after September 11th, articles began appearing in the Washington Post about how high-level officials in the FBI and CIA were contemplating torture. And by the end of 2002, articles were appearing in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and then most stunningly, really, an issue of The Economist magazine in January of 2003 that spoke of extraordinarily brutal interrogation methods in Afghanistan and said that there was basically no real debate occurring in the United States. These things were happening. They were happening in our name, that is, the people of this country. And nobody within the world of mainstream politics wanted to touch this with a 10-foot pole.
As you went through these contributions by these various contributors to this book, I wonder, did you learn something new? Was there something that surprised you?
I certainly learned a lot. One of the surprising things, one of the essays is by Yale professor of law, Ona Hathaway, who's done some of the most interesting empirical work, because one of the questions that Alan alludes to and one of your callers alludes to is that the United States, along with 130 other countries, has signed the United Nations Convention against torture and other inhuman and degrading acts. And if I can take literally about 40 seconds to read the most interesting section of that convention, it says, and this is a quote, "No exceptional circumstances whatsoever, whether a state of war or a threat of war, internal political instability, or any other public emergency, may be invoked as a justification of torture," unquote. So this really does have the United States and 130 other countries say in the most explicit language possible, we'll never do it regardless of the circumstances. What Professor Hathaway found is exactly what Alan Dershowitz has suggested, that a very high number of countries continue to engage in torture, even if they sign the convention. And then that leads to a question that she does discuss. Why do countries sign conventions like these when basically they have no intention of complying with them? And she has a variety of interesting answers to that question. Now, the United States, when it ratified the convention, might have intended to comply. Who expected that September 11th would occur? But as I say, what got me interested in this topic was that very shortly afterward, their debates began appearing on, well, maybe this was the exceptional situation, and the fact that the UN convention that the Senate ratified said we couldn't do it was basically cast aside. But let me make one other point. If you sign this kind of convention, you say, no, under no circumstances will we ever torture, then there is a huge incentive to define torture in a very extreme way, and then to say that anything short of that is all right. And that's exactly what the Bush administration has done in some memos that were leaked earlier this year, where it was discovered that the Office of Legal Counsel had defined torture as the infliction of, quote, excruciating pain, unquote, for a prolonged period. And then what basically the memorandum argued is that if it's not excruciating, it's merely pain and suffering. And I think that one of the things that's really quite terrible about the quality of the legal argument, but I blame the Senate as much as I blame the Justice Department lawyers, is that by defining torture at such an extreme level, and as an American, I feel insulted to be told that anything short of excruciating pain isn't really torture at all. I think we'd have a much healthier public debate if we adopted a much more, if you will, generous notion of what counts as torture, and then had the kind of debate that Allen and others have called for. I certainly respect the view that's going to be presented shortly by Jeremy Waldron, and there are some very, very eloquent essays in the book by Ariel Dorfman, by Elaine Scarry, by Richard Weisberg, all of which agree with what has come to be called the absolutist position. I certainly don't rule that position out, whether I agree with it in all respects, but what really appalls me is that the debate isn't occurring in public. We went through a very, very contentious political campaign. Neither President Bush nor Senator Kerry, for their own quite different political reasons, saw fit to raise the topic. Frankly, I was appalled that the issue of torture wasn't raised in the first presidential debate. So there has been a debate among academics. There's been a debate in some op-ed pieces. But our political leaders continue to want to pretend that there's nothing to talk about. And I think that's really the worst thing about the current situation with regard to torture.
We'll get to Jeremy Waldron in just a moment. But first, let's get a call in from Liz, who's dialing in from Cleveland.
Hi. I was curious if the professor could comment on how torture has changed, the nuances, since World War II, with new technology as well as the way that it's mediated.
You mean reported in terms of mediated?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've got an embarrassing. The engineer told me to move back a little bit, so if you could just quickly repeat the question, because I didn't get to hear all of it.
Liz, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. I'm just curious about, since World War II, the types of shifts that have been made since all this new technology, the internet, you know, the beheadings that we've seen, the way that it's reflected to people through the media.
Well, first of all, I think one has to understand things like the UN Convention, or for that matter, the passage of American domestic laws, as very much a response to the evils of World War II. There were many, many ways in which the Nazi regime was evil, but certainly one of them was its use of torture. And there is at least a rhetorical consensus after World War II that torture really is forbidden. To go back to Professor Hathaway's essay for a moment, one of the reasons that tyrannical regimes signed this convention is that it's a cheap gesture by which they can say they're part of civilized society, whether or not they actually intend to comply with it. Now, what you're pointing out, and again, Alan alluded to this, that what has developed in recent years is what's come to be called asymmetrical warfare, that's carried out in a variety of methods that are summarized as terrorism, and through use of new technologies like the internet. And one of the things we are certainly trying to do is to figure out how one does conduct such wars. It's it's going to be increasingly rare for one country to invade another country, though, as we saw in Iraq, that still occurs. What's, I think, unfortunately going to be much more common are incidents like September 11th, the bombing in Madrid, the bombings of the IRA in the 70s and 80s in London. And we are really grappling to figure out how we respond to that in a whole variety of ways.
Liz, thank you.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Jeremy Waldron, director of the Center for Law and Philosophy at Columbia Law School. He joins us now from his office in New York City, and it's good of you to join us today, too.
It's very good to be on the program.
Now, you believe that, like the UN Convention, torture is not justified under any circumstances whatsoever.
That's right. I think it's an absolute, both at the moral level, at the legal level, and probably you can make a pretty fair case pragmatically for having an absolute, even if you couldn't defend it at any of the other levels. I mean, morally, I think we just simply have to say, are we willing to do anything to human beings, and is there no limit to what we would contemplate in the sort of hypothetical case, or even the actual cases that Professor Dershowitz has mentioned?
Right.
For example, would we draw the line at raping the suspect who might have the information, or raping his girlfriend? Would we draw the line at terrorism ourselves in order to get the information? The logic of the hypotheticals that one has been hearing about on this program is that provided the numbers are right, provided the arithmetic is right, the amount of pain on one side and the amount of pain on the other side, then anything is permitted. And I do think I have very, very serious problems with that, that you cannot just treat human persons in any old way or treat them like objects to be emptied out of information and then thrown away, as one of your callers mentioned. Mm-hmm. That's the moral case. Pragmatically, we know that this torture is something which tends to metastasize. Torture is something that tends to grow. You start off using it under very, very carefully controlled conditions, but then it changes the office politics. You have a core of torturers standing around waiting for work. It incites a certain amount of opposition that increases the apprehensions of the authorities. And it's not used, I think Abu Ghraib showed us this, it's not used in areas where human motives are trustworthy. There's a degree of depravity and sadism waiting around there to pop up whenever the restraints on this are loosened. And I think the other thing to remember is the sort of emergency situations that we're contemplating are situations of panic and terror and fear and anger, and those may be situations in which the kind of fine philosophical calculations that Professor Dershowitz would ask us to consider may be the least trustworthy. So, you know, just for those pragmatic reasons of administrability, it may be that we would do better to hold the line with an absolute prohibition.
And what do you tell to the relatives of all those people in the Empire State Building, to use Alan Dershowitz's example, that, well, we might have been able to find the bomb, we don't know, but we didn't try?
That's right. We certainly tell them that we were not prepared to use evil. We were not prepared to mangle and break the dignity and agency of other human beings in order to save them, and that the primary responsibility for the deaths of their relatives remains with the terrorists who cause the atrocity. I think the other thing to remember is the legal situation. It's not just the United Nations Convention, it's the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Convention on Torture, which we signed, which both have, as Sandy Levinson just pointed out, an absolute non-negotiable ban on torture.
Mm-hmm.
We have a similar statute of our own in the United States Code enacted pursuant to our obligations under the Convention. But Neil, if I can just add this, we also have something that we might think about as the general spirit of our law, the background currents of principle that run through our legal heritage. And those are profoundly opposed to the idea of torture. I mean, you find this in the ethos that underpins the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel punishment. You find it in the ethos that strictly regulates what can be done in police interrogations or the gathering of evidence. You find it running through our elimination of the third degree from police station interrogations and so on, that the law as a whole has profoundly set aside or set its face against this business of getting its way through breaking the will or brutalizing and savagely destroying the spirit of human beings by torturing them. This is a deep-seated principle.
We're talking... Excuse me. We're talking about torture with Jeremy Waldron of Columbia Law School and with Sanford Levinson, the editor of the new book, Torture, A Collection. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another listener on the line. This is Adams. Adams calling from Ohio.
Yes. Hi, guys.
Hi.
I just tuned in a few minutes ago. I had the pleasure of listening to the other person that was in on the conversation.
Yes.
Quickly, my view on writing treaties and coming up with different ways, you know, that we're, as humans, we're progressing and it's time to lay down the law and to move forward as humanity, you know, to face different things. And just like everyone's progressing, that's just the nature of human beings. However, when you have certain types of people, let's call them terrorists or people that want to inflict pain on other people, and they can't sit down, you know, at a table like people did for the treaties and say, listen, we have something we want to discuss. Like, if they can't do it in a civil manner, and the only way they can do it is, you know, to regress and to use methods that are obviously barbaric, then I think to be able to handle these people, we might have to resort to barbaric things as well. I mean, we have to be on the same playing field as them.
Adam, I think we got it. Let's get a response from Jeremy Waldron.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right to emphasize that we have this progressive aspect to our human rights law and to the international covenants. And these were not just envisaged as progressive ways of dealing with peaceful situations or progressive ways of dealing with decent people. These were envisaged as progressive ways of dealing with these dangerous and terrifying situations. So what we committed ourselves to was that even in dangerous and terrifying considerations, we would not stoop to that level. So I think it's very, very important to indicate the nature of the progress that has been made. We didn't used to believe this, we do now. And as I say, I think it resonates throughout our law, not just in these particular treaties.
Could I break in?
We just have a couple of minutes left, so please go ahead.
Okay. I think one of the things that Jeremy's comments point out is that this debate really takes one back to what I sometimes refer as Philosophy 101, that Jeremy is a very, very eloquent proponent of the view that basically let justice be done though the heavens fall. And then on the other side can be a form of utilitarianism that says let's just do a cost-benefit analysis and if the benefits outweigh the cost, then do it. I'm reluctant to embrace either one. The problem is whether or not you can find something sensible in the center. I do want to address one of Jeremy's particular examples. That is, he talked about what would we do to the person we considered the terrorist, him or herself, and then what would we do, say, to a terrorist's girlfriend. I'm more willing to contemplate the possibility of torturing a terrorist under very, very specific circumstances, because after all, by definition, it's the terrorist who has put us in danger, and you can frame this as self-defense. I move much closer to Jeremy's position with regard to torturing the innocent girlfriend or threatening to kill the child or the parents of the terrorist. At that point, if I were ever to contemplate that, it really would require demonstration that the heavens were about to fall and nothing less.
All these questions and many other interesting questions on the subject of torture are presented in a collection called Torture. It's edited by Sanford Levinson. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jeremy Waldron, you also heard from there. He is a director of the Center for Law and Philosophy at Columbia Law School. Jeremy, the Sanford Levinson is at the University of Texas at Austin. He joins us from KUT there. When we come back from a short break, we're going to talk about a possible eruption of mad cow disease. Another case? Maybe.